Welcome to the On Messianic Judaism podcast. This is episode 17 in our podcast, and I'm really pleased to share with you our guest, Rabbi Joshua Brumbach. Rabbi Joshua is the senior rabbi of Simchat Yisrael in West Haven, Connecticut, and serves as adjunct faculty at Messianic Jewish Theological Institute and the King's University. He is an accredited Jewish educator, studied in an Orthodox yeshiva in Europe, and is ordained by the Union of Messianic Jewish Congregations and the Messianic Jewish Rabbinical Council. He is currently pursuing a doctorate in early rabbinic literature at Spertus Institute of Jewish Learning and Leadership. This is Daniel Nassim, and today is the second in our second series of the On Messianic Judaism podcast. That makes it our 17th episode in total. In the coming weeks, we will continue to explore the history of the Messianic Jewish movement in its earliest or nascent days and its modern or renascent days. This second series will also include some interviews, the first of which is now, as I am about to interview Rabbi Joshua Brumbach. Today we'll be discussing his recent commentary on the letter of Jude in the New Testament. Jude, or more properly Judah, was Yeshua's brother. He is one of two of Yeshua's brothers to write books that are now in the New Testament canon. I highly recommend that you get a copy of Rabbi Joshua's commentary, and a link to the publisher's website is in the comments for this podcast. To make sure that you are notified when I upload that episode, take a moment to subscribe to this podcast wherever you are listening to it, and you will get notified as soon as it is published. So anyway, as I said, it's really great to see you, Joshua, and I'm glad that you're settling in well on the East Coast and enjoying life out there. And you were just telling me that you're studying at the Spertus Institute for your PhD, I gather, right?
Yeah, for my DHL. It's a Doctor in Hebrew Letters.
Wow. All right. That's fantastic. And what particularly are you focusing on in your studies?
So my focus is early Judaism, and particularly early rabbinic literature. And I'm in the proposal phase for my dissertation, but it looks like I'm going to be doing protest theology in Midrash Tehillim, which is protest theology, just quick in a nutshell, is all throughout the Bible and scripture, there are tons of theological challenges that are posed towards God in the sense of, for example, Abraham. After he goes to Pharaoh for the first time, he comes back and he has this whole conversation with God. I did exactly what you said and it didn't work. And in fact, you made things worse, right?
Right.
Or
right.
All throughout the Psalms, my God, why have you forsaken me? There's these challenges that people pose to God as they're trying to work through what is going on in their life. Right. So that those kinds of working out our faith happens also in rabbinic literature. And especially in Midrash. And so I'm going to be looking at this type of literature and this type of what they call protest theology in the collection of Midrash on the Book of Psalms called Midrash Tehillim.
Well, that sounds fantastic. I look forward to
it. I mean, I'm obviously excited.
And hopefully you're still excited after you've gone through all the writing.
Right, after I've written the dissertation.
Yeah, that's always grueling, but it's always nice to come out the other end too. It's an experience you can't match.
Right.
Yeah, so that'll be awesome. Really looking forward to that.
Well, thank you for this opportunity to have a little chat with you. I'm looking forward.
That's really great. I'm hoping in this podcast, we're now in series number two, and we have focused in the first series particularly and exclusively on the history of Messianic Judaism up to the first centuries. And we began with Ezra, because that's where Judaism begins, and Messianic Judaism is a Judaism. And so we're going to continue that into the Gaonic era in the next year, please God. But I also wanted to bring in theologians and messianic perspectives that I think are really important for our movement. We need to know our history, but we also need to know our theology and our philosophy.
Right.
And
right,
so absolutely. This is where your commentary on the book of Jude is really fantastic.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, it's really one of the first commentaries to come out in the Lederer Messianic Commentary series. And, you know, you wrote it a few years ago, and I'm really enjoying it. You know, it's a good book, easily available, of course, on Amazon or anywhere else. Mm-hmm. But it's also a short commentary, which one shouldn't be surprised at, considering that Jude is a fairly short book. In fact, it doesn't even have chapters, just verses. Right. So, yeah, maybe you could tell us who Jude was, though. I mean, this is fascinating.
So even since I wrote, so the book came out in 2014, and then after that, I actually did one on the letters of John. But the Jude book is, so Jude is, since then, I was going to say that I've done so much more work on the family of Yeshua that, you know, someday I'll go in and update the book and everything, but Jude is one of the brothers of Yeshua. So Yeshua, people often, we think so much about Yeshua or the historical Jesus, right? Yeshua, that we don't often give much attention to the family of Yeshua. And two of his brothers played significant roles within the early believing community. And in fact, all the way up until around the year 135, when the last of Yeshua's descendants, not Yeshua's descendants, but of the family of Yeshua, the family of Yeshua played a particular important role within the believing community all the way up until 135, when I believe it's Yehuda Caracas is killed during the Bar Kokhba revolt. Sometime during that time, and he is a grandson of Jude. So Jude is one of the brothers of Yeshua. He writes a letter that we have today in the New Testament. And one of the reasons why I wanted to write on this book was I feel that it's so often neglected. Very rarely do you hear a sermon on Jude. Very rarely do you hear anybody quote from it or talk about. And yet it's from one of Yeshua's own brothers, right? Who played a very important role in the leadership of the community. And he has a lot of really important things to say in this short, tiny little book. At the same time, the more that I got into the book, the more that I saw how challenging, and you can see why it makes people often uncomfortable. And so I think that's also lends to why you don't hear too much on it, but it's a great book. And especially, like I said, by one of the actual brothers of Yeshua.
Yeah, I think that's fantastic, because when you look at a book like that through a lens that incorporates Jewish perspective and Jewish history and philosophy and so forth, it comes out as a little bit of a midrash, a little bit of, you know, apocalyptic.
Right.
And it really fits in Jewish literature, I can hear you saying, you know, better than it fits into the typical conception of what New Testament literature is, exactly. And what the boundaries of the canon are, and so forth.
Exactly.
Yeah. So Jude is obviously Judah or Yehuda.
Right.
And yeah, point that out.
You know, his name was actually Judah, or Yehuda is what it is in Hebrew, or Judas in Greek. And so it's interesting that we call him Jude, but I think part of that, the modern English pronunciation is sort of different than the way it came into Old English, where the E would have been emphasized, Judah. It would actually been Yuda. And then as the J becomes hardened in more modern type of English, it's kind of like how we get the pronunciation of Jesus today. But the same thing happens with Jude. We also shortened it and we took off that last syllable.
Yeah, I think that there aren't many languages that have butchered biblical names as badly as English.
Quite as badly as English has.
Yeah, it really has.
I think that's true.
But it does, it's so helpful, like with the book of James, it's so helpful to remember that the author's name was Yehuda, or in James's case, Yaakov.
Yaakov, right.
Yeah.
Right.
And it makes us think, and it makes us look at the whole thing through a different lens. And right. I think that's important. So I wanted to ask you, who do you think this book was primarily written to?
So that's a really good question. And it's one of the debates among scholars is the audience. What I end up proposing in my book is I believe that the book is written primarily to a Jewish believing audience, but in the diaspora. And there are reasons for this. But one of the main things that people often forget is the majority of there are more Jews already by the time of Yeshua who live outside of Israel than inside of Israel. And there are books like, for example, James writes his letter, and one of the epistles of that we attribute to Peter was also, it begins by saying to the 12 tribes in the diaspora. Jude is an interesting book in that, and this is one of the reasons why I believe it's written primarily towards Jews, is even though it's written in Greek, and by the way, and you know this, is even though we often call the type of Greek in the New Testament Koine Greek, which means common, it's not even really Koine Greek. It's what we would better call Jewish Greek, right? It's right. Often, other than a couple of books in the New Testament, which there's some debate over, everything is written by people who are non-native Greek speakers, right? So they write with Hebraisms. They write with often slipping in not only Hebraisms and vocabulary, but also the grammar and everything. And often with some of the books in the New Testament, when they quote from the Tanakh, from the Hebrew scriptures, they'll often just use the Septuagint because it's easier. If I'm not fluent in, you know, completely fluent in a language, it's easier just to copy it from something that's already translated rather than doing the right. translation on my own. Now, Jude doesn't do this, which is fascinating. So Jude, whenever he translates, and he's always working with these Tanakh types, like what right. he uses stuff from the Tanakh. And there are two places where he does these three sets of types from the Tanakh. And then he also, which makes Jude unique, is it's the only book in the New Testament to directly quote or allude to apocryphal, you know, extra biblical literature. And in these, he translates them from the Hebrew. And right. so that means his translation is going to be a little different than the Septuagint and the way that it appears maybe in other New Testament texts, because he's translating it off of his mind. So it's clear when you look at his translation that he's actually working off the Hebrew-based texts and not using the Septuagint, the Greek translation of these yeah. words, doing the translation yeah. on his own.
And that brings up the fact that a lot of people wonder about whether Jude or Yehuda was actually Yeshua's brother, because his Greek seems to be so good and so fluent.
Right, right.
And frankly, I don't personally get that argument, because, first of all, Yeshua came from a fairly well-educated home. I think that is evident from hints in the Gospels and elsewhere. Mm-hmm. He was an educated person. Secondly, this book was probably written in Jerusalem or maybe in Pella or someplace mm-hmm. like that, but it was in the environs of, you know, in the core of right. the Jewish world. Right. And there were, as we know from Book of Acts, never mind Jewish sources, a mm-hmm. lot of Hellenic Jews and a lot of people whom he could have sat down with and had them work with him on his text.
Right. Well, and so Richard Bauckham, you know, a great Bible scholar in the UK, he makes a really good argument for the possibility of Jude being the author, despite, you know, the Greek that's used. The, as you mentioned, the Greek of Jude is pretty good, but it still betrays Jude's being a non-native right. speaker, right? But his use, and especially his grasp of vocabulary, Richard Bauckham kind of attributes to the possibility that because it's written so late, Jude was very young when he started his work, you know, following Yeshua. And given that he then had a few decades to improve his Greek as they're working more and more in the diaspora. And again, like you mentioned, I think it's time to recognize that more people than we often consider were familiar with Greek, even in Israel at that right. time, even in places like the Galilee. But over the decades of working and going out on, you know, their journeys to all these various communities that were being planted across the diaspora, his Greek would have really improved. And yeah. given, you know, his education and exposure, I think, as Richard Bauckham says, it's not surprising then that his grasp of Greek would be what it is. But then also given the other factors, why it also betrays, you know, the Hebraisms and stuff that he would use.
Yeah. Yeah.
As a Galilean Jew.
Yeah, that's absolutely fair. I think that's very true. What I find fascinating, and I want to show these books to our viewers, is how much literature there is. And of course, mm-hmm. you know these books really well. These two volumes are the major portion, but by far not all that we have of ancient pseudepigrapha or and so forth. Jewish writings that were floating around in Yeshua and Yehuda's time, and never mind the Apocrypha that, you know, everyone is aware of that as well. And we have the Midrash and the Targumim and other things that also are part of that literature. So
The Midrash stuff is later, but these But these earlier works really help to set the stage for what we read in the New Testament. And I think people often miss this, right? It's just how much these works. For example, the Book of Enoch is directly quoted by Jude, but you can see the theology of Enoch all throughout the New Testament, all throughout the Gospels and stuff. So all this extra biblical work, you know, unless you're like us and kind of love this world and nerd out on it, people aren't really, they don't think about the fact that life continued after the close of the Tanakh. I mean, when what is often called the New Testament, you know, that we Jews call the Tanakh, when it was kind of began to be sort of closed off and then sort of codified, life went on and Jews continued to write. And there's, you know, this vast wealth in the Apocrypha and pseudepigraphic writings. And all of that influences then the writers of the New Testament. And you see this thinking, especially in Jude, which I find very fascinating because there's not yet a set canon in the way that we understand that idea. So for them, they're still working with a lot of these ideas and these texts, which are just circulating as normal within the Jewish world. And so that often does get reflected in the theology of the New Testament and why it's important to at least be, you know, somewhat familiar with some of this stuff.
Yeah, I think what you're saying is interesting, because even in such familiar passages as where Yeshua says, "You will see the Son of Man coming in the clouds of heaven," that is not just Daniel, the book of Daniel. That is actually Enoch, which Yehuda is quoting from in the book of Jude.
When I like to point out too to people, especially by the time you get to the, and I think this is very clear, a great example is in Hebrews, the way that Melchizedek is depicted there, if you're honest, you can't get to the Melchizedek of Hebrews simply from the Tanakh, right? If you were to simply look at the Tanakh, that when you have the Genesis reference, what is it, 14, I think, where Melchizedek appears, is it's this figure. He's called simply the King of Shalem, and he's some kind and a priest of, you know, the one God. And Abraham does bring a tithe to him, but he's clearly an earthly figure, at least if you read on the plain sense meaning of Genesis. There is a little more lofty understanding by the time you get to the only other reference to Melchizedek in the Hebrew scriptures in the book of Psalms, right? That right. It does kind of seem to hint at a developing understanding that this figure is more than just a human figure. But the only way to jump to the type of really advanced understanding of Melchizedek in the book of Hebrews is you have to be familiar with the developing tradition of Melchizedek in extra-biblical writings, like, for example, the Melchizedek scroll and the Dead Sea Scrolls and things like that. And then you see, it's not such a big jump. You see a development of there's this evolving idea of Melchizedek as some kind of divine figure, not divine meaning that he's God, but some kind of elevated figure.
Yeah, elevated is a really good way to put it. And I'm wondering, you know, as we're talking about pseudepigrapha, and that's, you know, such a, I suppose, Western term, because...
Of course it is, but it's the term that, if anybody has ever heard of this stuff, it might be the term that they're familiar with.
Yeah, that's right. But what I want to ask is, how do you see this as impacting maybe the way that we as Messianic Jews and Christians as well... view that literature and receive it, you know, and deal with it? Because typically, particularly in Protestant circles, it is marginalized almost to the extreme.
Right. My view and kind of what I advocate in the book is that I don't use these words, but I think we shouldn't be afraid of it. Obviously, we don't hold it to the same level that we would what we call the canonical scriptures, like what most of us have in our Bibles. At the same time, it is a type of biblical literature. And even though it didn't become canon, we need to recognize not only what it is, but the influence that it ends up playing on canonical scripture that within the New Testament. And so I don't think we should be afraid of it. We should be familiar with it, but also its limitations. It's not canon, and we wouldn't necessarily hold it in the same regard. But I do think it has a place within, it's obviously, we're talking about more mature believers and stuff who are understand kind of the historical context of all of this stuff. But yeah, I don't think we should be afraid of it. And I think it has it's already played a role, whether we want to acknowledge it or not. You can try to pretend and ignore that this has no influence, but it did influence it just by some of the examples that we've already given. And so it's better to acknowledge that and be familiar with it, at least on a very basic level.
Yeah. That's a pretty good approach, but it also has some implications maybe in how we look at the literature that grew out of that as well, because these early writings also have a role in the development of Haggadah and Midrash later on.
Oh, absolutely. You know? Absolutely. There's a clear evolution, not only in the ideas, but even in the style of writings. And Midrash is a great example that you see already in scripture, the retelling of stories, right? Yeah. All throughout scripture, you have a retelling. For example, Chronicles is a much later book than Kings, and it retells Kings, but with sometimes very different details. It retells and reinterprets the stories. Psalms does that, right? It's telling of the Exodus narrative, kind of gives little different nuances of things. And I'm not saying they're competing, and I don't want anybody to, you know, get the wrong idea. But I'm just saying that there's a sense of retelling, and that's what ends up happening, not only through this extra biblical literature, but then that's what Midrash does. It takes these details and it expands upon them, and it retells the stories, but then exploring various, you know, even sometimes possible to use, you know, comic book terms, different universes, alternative reality, you know, like what if it's not intending to say that the biblical text is wrong. What it does by looking at the biblical text, it asks hard questions like, what if it was this way? Or what if we read it a little bit of a different way? Or what, you know, sometimes so much of the Bible, we often think that the Bible is so detailed, but then when you go to explore it in further detail, you realize a lot of the detail is missing. And there's a lot of times we don't have dialogue. And Midrash right. will sometimes say, well, what was it that Abraham exactly said to, you know, to right. Isaac or whoever? It'll explore some of these. And it's, you know, it's sermonic in the sense of when you hear a sermon, it's not intended to be literal. This is the way it was in the Bible. It's meant to often the sermon kind of brings it out and applies it to our daily lives today and explores issues. How would you relate this? What does it look like? And what kind of spiritual lessons can I learn from this, you know, from this text,
yeah.
the biblical text?
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I think also it has an effect, and I'm curious what you think about this, an effect on maybe how we look at the chain of oral tradition. Because although my personal view is that literacy followed Israel, it was a significant part of national life, whether most Absolutely. People read or not,
right.
Since the time of Moses.
Right.
But knowledge, because writing materials were scarce and expensive, was basically orally transmitted. Mm-hmm. And we in our culture today, we tend to downplay oral transmission of these historical memories that maybe are what we see in Chronicles, recounting with additional details that have been passed down orally over the centuries.
Right.
And without arguing for the the infallibility of oral tradition and the infallibility of Pirkei Avot 1:1, where it lays out that oral tradition.
Right.
There is some validity and value in it. And you see that in Jude, would you say?
Well, and I think that that's true. At the same time, I think that when we're talking about some of these things, that there's almost we're almost talking about two different things at the same time that are related. One is the sense of collective memory, what we tell and retell ourselves. And sometimes in that retelling, there are different things that are brought out or even remembered, right? This is the way that we often understand some of the differences within the Gospels, is that there are different individuals who are kind of telling different scenarios or details from their perspective, right? That everybody is going to record and end up recording, you know, generally the same thing, but there's also little details that kind of get in there. At the same time, there is something that is evolving and developing, and which isn't just transmitted from one generation to another, but the way that by the way each generation relates to the text, they intentionally, you know, collect certain things and don't collect certain things. You know, it's really kind of an evolving of the message, but it means that the details sometimes either change or they're added to or whatever. There was a point that I was going to make that I don't remember, but anyway, I think it's important. One of my points was that I think what we're talking about when we get to, especially the development of the rabbinic oral tradition that we call it, it's not oral tradition in the sense of passed down memory. It is a created, although it has kernels of historic transmitted, it's also a developed thing in order to create a Judaism that can survive without, you know, without a temple, without a priesthood, without sacrifices. It really has to develop a new type of Judaism that's based on these things. It's biblical in the sense of just like any followers of God today would say that they're biblical, but you know what I mean? But then developing on something that's new in some ways, at the same time, it's old, right? But it's not the oral tradition when, for example, Paul over and over again refers to the tradition of our fathers.
Yes.
What the rabbis end up speaking of as oral tradition is not exactly the same thing that Paul is speaking of. But at the same time, what you see is there is this tradition that keeps being passed on and a memory that's retained. And Even in our practices and liturgy, that we retain a certain level of memory in what we're doing and what we're passing on.
Yeah. And I think Jude, again, reflects that whole mentality that this is all part of the world as he sees it and part of his horizon and so forth. So when you look at Jude, now to get maybe to its message, what would you say its key core messages to the Messianic Jewish movement today?
I mean, Jude begins his letter by saying, I intended to write you a totally different letter, but I felt that there was an issue that needed to be addressed. And his primary concern of writing the letter was to deal with what he saw as heresy, right? These false teachings that were creeping into the community. And this it kind of becomes a common theme in other letters in the New Testament, of addressing false teachings and false teachers that begin to arise. This is a big concern in the letters of John, for example. At the same time, I think Jude is trying to do two things. He's trying to address what he sees as false teaching and heresy that is creeping into, and the primary heresy that he's addressing. So it's not just heresy in general, but the primary heresy in general is almost a type of a misinterpretation of grace, right? That I can basically do whatever I want and then just, you know, God will forgive me, right? Kind of a thing. Right. So he's trying to address false teaching that he sees as dangerous, but also provide hope to people. This is even why I came up with in the title of the book. It's called Jude on Faith and the Destructive Influence of Heresy, because these are the two issues that Jude is dealing with. He's dealing with heresy or in false teaching, and also providing hope to the audience that he's addressing, that there is hope for us to believe. And this is why he ends with this beautiful doxology.
Yeah. Yeah. That sounds, you know, appropriate and good. So coming to the end of it, one of the things you did in your commentary that isn't often done, and I think people know about it or in the scholarly world, but it isn't talked about, is the order of the canon.
Yeah,
and,
right.
You know, Jude is the penultimate, the second from last book in the canon, which is really part, I'm sure, of how it has been received. And sometimes people look at that and say, you know, what's going on here? So you had a really great chart with Codex Vaticanus, Codex Sinaiticus, and Alexandrinus showing the different orders that they follow.
Yeah, there's a chart.
Yeah, there it is.
Yeah.
It's really helpful, just laying it right out there. Well, what are your thoughts about that?
So I think that you're touching on something that is extremely important that you're right. People don't think about very often, and that's the order of things. Going back to your comment earlier about an oral tradition and an oral message, there's an important reason why the books of the, so just in case people are not aware, the Christian Old Testament is the same as the Jewish Bible, what we call the Tanakh or the Hebrew Scriptures. The only difference is they're in a different order. And because they tell a different narrative arc, right? That for Israel, there's this narrative arc, which is different than the narrative arc that is told by reading it through the Christian canon. And people don't think about it that way. You know, there's a reason on purpose that the Christian canon ends with Malachi, so that the very last thing you read is, "Behold, I will send you the prophet Elijah before the great and terrible day of the Lord." And then you go right into the Gospels and you read that John the Baptist, John the Immerser, comes in the spirit and power of Elijah. This is a fulfillment of that, right? And so there's a certain arc in order to point you towards the Messiah that, you know, the Christian canon looks at. But by changing the narrative arc, you are emphasizing different things, right? And so the Jewish canon emphasizes a different arc because it's concerned about Israel's, our story, rather than trying to point you to another collection per se. But the order of the New Testament, people don't think about often that the order that we have it today wasn't always the order. And the reason why I wanted to show in that chart is that today, the order of the New Testament canon emphasizes, first and foremost, the way it should be, the message of Yeshua, right? The life and message of Yeshua. And then it goes into Paul's writings, right? After you have Acts, so you have the Gospels and Acts, and then it emphasizes Paul's writings, which are to the Gentiles, right? And so it makes sense that as the church becomes predominantly Gentile, that they would want the books that are primarily written towards them. Also, Paul writes the most books. writes the most significant number of books. But when you go back into some of the oldest some of the oldest orders of the New Testament, they actually start after the Gospels and Acts with the what we now call the general letters. And it's Paul's writings that are towards the end. And I think something going on is very important, and that when, and this is the point that I make in the book that I feel is a very important book, is now it's easy with Jude kind of being the penultimate book of just kind of stuck at the end right before Revelation to dismiss it, right? It's the book I just jump over in order to get to the good stuff in Revelation. But what if it was earlier, right? Just like it was in ancient times. If I read Jude before I read Paul, would it change not only the way that I view Jude and the importance of Jude's book, but would it then also change the way that I read Paul afterwards? I think that this is a really important question because I think order does matter. And there's a narrative arc. We know when you construct a story, the order that you put things changes the emphases of your storyline.
Right.
I think it's important when we think about the overall message, the narrative arc of the New Testament, I think it's important to consider, like it was in many ancient, you know, orders, when the general letters are put first, and Jude is right. what we call now the general letters.
We're never going to be able to change that order.
Right, right. Again, and I'm not necessarily arguing that we all now reorder our Bibles per se, but I think it's important to consider when we're talking, you know, seriously about the context of these things.
Yeah, it absolutely is. And that's why I wanted to bring it up. Mm-hmm. I think maybe as we come to an end, what would you say is the most revolutionary thing you say in the book?
The most revolutionary.
Maybe that's a tough sell there.
I think it's a good question, but it's kind of a hard one. I would say that the most valuable things to get out of it is to realize that it's number one, that it's far more important than it's often given credit for. And number two, it is more relevant than people realize, right? But number three, it is full of some hard stuff. And it's stuff that some people would consider very controversial today. And this is why I think where it makes people squirm, like we're uncomfortable with discussions of sex with angels, for example, you know, that's considered pretty taboo for a lot of people, but Jude addresses this, right? And if you're familiar with what I'm talking about, this whole history and interpretation of what are called the Nephilim, the fallen ones, and this kind of stuff that people, there's some stuff in there that makes people squeamish. But at the same time, what it does is it reveals for us conversations that ancient figures were comfortable talking about, or at least addressing hard things and not ignoring them, not necessarily making them commonplace, but they were willing to have difficult conversations, right? So to me, I think that we need to be able to wrestle with difficult conversations too, whether we agree or disagree with the outcome, but being able to have hard conversations, especially in a world like ours that has become so polarized, that we need to be able to have conversations with one another that are not about always agreeing, but being able to have hard, you know, and difficult conversations.
Yeah.
And I think you know, not that Jude is the template for that per se, but to encourage us that sometimes to be able to explore and be open to ideas that are different from what we're used to.
Yeah. So the book of Jude seems to me to be part of that tapestry of emerging, or maybe not so much emerging as maturing, messianic Jewish theology that takes into account, you know, the fantastic scholarship done over the last centuries by many different scholars, but also contributes a sensitivity to those issues that we've been talking about, its place in the Jewish world, in the Jewish conceptual world, and so forth, and also its value to us as followers and disciples of Yeshua today.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with your assessment that it really is for it's a mature faith, because it raises questions and it raises discussions that you need to be on a more familiar and mature level in order to really deal with some of these things. And so, you know, as I mentioned in the sort of in the preface of the book, it's a small book that packs a huge wallop, you know, an intellectual wallop, because there's a lot crammed into that little tiny book, and it is more relevant as we live in a world where there is a lot of false teachers, right? A lot of people who want to lay claim to the gospel message or, you know, the truth of scripture, but their lifestyles or their teachings don't match up with it. Like, we need to be aware of these things, and we need to realize that not everybody is out for our best interest. You know, they don't have the pastoral concern. I think this is what I love about Jude, is it raises, you see not only clearly the Jewish context out of which Jude is writing and the concerns that he has, but also the pastoral care that he has, right? His concern is for the people that he's writing to, that they don't fall into some of these ideas that he sees as contrary to true biblical faith.
Yes. Yeah, so that's valuable. I just want to mention to our listeners, if you want to connect with Rabbi Joshua, he's on Twitter as Reb Yosh, R-E-B-Y-O-S-H, on Instagram as Reb Yosh.
Yeah, Reb Yosh. Yeah.
Facebook, Rabbi Joshua Brumbach. And you're the rabbi of Simchat Yisrael, and Simchat Yisrael also has a website, simchatyisrael.org. And if you wish to get this book, it's available on Amazon. It's really a valuable resource, Jude on the Faith and the Destructive Influence of Heresy. You can find it either on Amazon or go directly to the Lederer Ministries website, Messianic Books. So thank you very much, Joshua, for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me, Daniel. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, I've really enjoyed talking to you about this book. And I do hope that people will, as a result of this, maybe they'll buy the book, but even more so if they will get into studying the book of Jude more for themselves.
Right. Absolutely. And that's my hope in, you know, the whole point of the book was for people to take this book, you know, meaning the book of Jude, more seriously. And so if people do that, even as a result of this, you know, interaction and discussion that you and I had today, then I will achieve my purpose.
Yes. All right. Well, thank you so much for writing it as well. I know it's not for the money or the fame.
Right.
So it's a great contribution to Messianic Jewish thought. And this book is part of a commentary series to which you've also contributed, you said, on 1st, 2nd Peter?
On John, the letters
on
of
John.
Yeah.
Okay, John's three letters. And that's, you know, maybe for another day.
Yeah.
But hopefully someday this commentary series will be complete and people will be able to buy the entire series, but that'll be a few years from now.
Yeah. Yeah. From what I understand.
Yeah. Great. Well, thank you, Joshua.
Yeah. Thank you again for your time.
Thank you for joining us and listening to our podcast. Do me a favor, take a minute to like this podcast and leave a positive review wherever you are listening to it. Support our podcast by going to onmessianicjudaism.com. And before I end, if you like my material, you can go to my YouTube channel, also called the On Messianic Judaism channel, for some different content on Messianic Judaism. My email address is daniel@naseem.org, and I'm looking forward to your feedback. I am Dr. Daniel Naseem, and this is On Messianic Judaism.